equation with more accuracy than classical Newtonian physics can. But that's nothing you need to concern yourself about. While gravitational time dilation caused by an accelerating inertial reference frame moving through highly curved areas of spacetime is a fascinating topic, and one that's also extremely useful when constructing FC3000 rental market time machines, unless you happen to bring your copy of Good Grief, You Say Space and Time Are But Two Aspects of a Single Continuum Called Spacetime, and furthermore, that the speed of light in a vacuum is the same for all observers of that light regardless of the motion of the light source, well, here are 1001 educational comics about general and special relativity that explore those ideas further, back in time with you, we wouldn't worry about it just yet. End of footnote. If you have a heavy wheel that takes a lot of energy to start spinning, it'll also take a lot of energy to stop it, and that makes them batteries that store momentum instead of electricity. Wheels will slow down over time due to friction, so they're not perfect batteries, but a dense or large flywheel can run for a really long time before it stops. They were first used in pottery. Potter's wheels are just big heavy wheels that spin for a while once you get them moving, and that, my clay-covered friend, is a flywheel. But, and again, no surprises here, it took humans a while to realize they could be used for anything else. Turns out, all you need to do is attach them to a rod rotated by an engine, and you're in business. Besides storing energy, they can also be used to smooth out machinery. In piston engines, section 10.5.4, the pistons move intermittently, and in many uses you'll want constant power. If you're powering a tractor, for example, you'll probably want to move forward at an even pace rather than in fits and starts every time a piston fires. If your pistons power a flywheel instead of your machinery directly, the wheel will continue to rotate even when the pistons aren't providing power, generating a much smoother force. Here we have an image, figure 21, which is just a wheel on a stick. The image is labeled a flywheel, also known by its less technical term, wheel on a stick. Flywheels can also release energy faster than it was originally produced. It might take you hours to get a flywheel up to speed, but attach a heavy load to your flywheel and you can direct all that energy towards doing work in an instant, giving you access to brief but powerful bursts of energy far beyond what you can normally produce. There is, of course, an upper limit on how much energy any flywheel can store. Once a wheel rotates fast enough, it exceeds its own tensile strength, tears itself apart, and all those shards fly off at an incredibly fast speed. This is why a steel flywheel is safer than a cast iron one. Steel's greater strength minimizes the chance any flywheel inside your machinery transforms itself into a surprise metal bomb. You can increase the energy any flywheel stores by increasing either its size or its speed. The energy stored in a rotating wheel is related to the square of its speed, so a smaller fast wheel will get better results than a large slow one. And finally, while flywheels may seem old-fashioned, they aren't just used on piston-powered machinery. Experimental flywheels were constructed by NASA in 2004 CE as a way to cheaply and reliably store energy in space. So, technically, by inventing the flywheel, you've also taken the first steps towards your new civilization's space program. Nice. 10.5.4. Steam engines. The introduction of so powerful an agent as steam to a carriage on wheels will make a great change in the situation of humanity. You. Also, Thomas Jefferson. What they are. Engines that use the fact that water takes up more space when it's boiled to get things done, which is a technology so useful that when they finally got invented, society restructured itself around these machines in an event we call the Industrial Revolution. Before they were invented, if you wanted something done, you had to do it yourself, or get an animal to do it, or pay someone else to do it, but you certainly couldn't just boil some water and call it a day. Originally invented, 100 CE for steam-powered toys that were technically steam turbines, 1606 CE for the earliest steam-powered water pump, 1698 CE for the first practical steam-powered pump, 1765 CE for the separate condensation chamber, which was commercialized in 1776, 1783 CE for steam-powered boats, 1804 CE for steam-powered trains, and 1884 CE for the reinvention of steam turbines. Prerequisites: iron for boilers, cast iron for piston rings and cylinders, steel, and welding. How to invent? Steam engines probably sound old-fashioned, but even today the vast majority of electricity worldwide is generated with steam. The only real difference between old-fashioned steam engines and our newfangled ones is instead of burning wood in our boilers, we use coal, gas, or the godlike powers of the very atoms themselves. That's right. Even with the civilization-ending power of nuclear reactors at our disposal, we still mostly just use them to boil us up some water. The earliest steam engines were invented without much scientific theory behind how they work, so merely by flipping through this section before you decide to throw a steam engine together, you're already starting off on a better foot than its original inventors ever did. It's been said that science owes more to the steam engine than the steam engine owes to science, and while that's not true, science don't owe nobody nothing. It does give you a sense of how much humans were able to learn by studying these engines they'd invented, including, but not limited to, the second law of thermodynamics. Footnote. The first law of thermodynamics, the law of conservation of energy, is that energy cannot be created or destroyed, but it can be changed. In other words, any increase of energy in a system will be equal to the energy put into that system. The second law is that entropy, or chaos, in a closed system is always increasing. In other words, things don't just get spontaneously more organized. Instead, they fall apart. It's worth noting that things have gotten more organized on Earth. Life has evolved, buildings have been built, and so on. But that's because Earth isn't a closed system. It's powered by the sun. The third law of thermodynamics is that the entropy in a system approaches zero as that system approaches absolute zero. The colder things get, the less entropy you have. When you're at absolute zero, the coldest possible temperature in the universe, all physical motion ceases. End footnote. A steam engine is made of two parts. A boiler, which uses some form of combustion to boil water, producing steam under pressure, and an engine that uses that steam to move a piston, turbine, or itself. The boiler part is easy once you've got metal. Just have airtight pipes of water that run through your fire-heated combustion chamber. This is called a water tube boiler. Or have pipes of fire-heated gas that run through your airtight and partially filled water chamber. This is a fire tube boiler. Either produces pressurized steam and introduces the risk of your boilers exploding, so heads up on that, but water tubes tend to be cheaper. Once you've got steam, you can run it through a second combustion chamber to heat it up even more, producing a superheated steam that carries more energy and can therefore do more work. Superheated steam can also be cooled a bit without it condensing back into water, which is great because then you don't have to worry about water clogging up your nice new steam engine all the time. Putting steam to work in an engine can be done in a couple of ways, and the simplest is to inject steam into a piston. A piston is simply a mass that moves freely inside a cylinder, and it takes a little bit of precision engineering. You need a metal cylinder that's the same width all around, and a piston that's just slightly smaller so it can move freely within that tube. Footnote. Making cylinders by hand will work, but you'll probably introduce irregularities to their shape, which lets steam escape around the piston and makes your engine less efficient. The solution is to make your cylinders slightly smaller than what you need, run a straight metal bar through the middle, and send a drill along that bar. The drill enlarges the cylinder to a constant size, and the metal bar prevents it from following imperfections in the cylinder as it moves forward, which produces a regularly shaped tube. End footnote. To give this piston an airtight seal, you can attach a cast iron ring to your piston, a spring-loaded piece of metal that makes constant contact with the cylinder. Before cast iron seals, pistons would have hemp tightly wrapped around their bases as a seal. Hemp is dense, it doesn't wear out quickly under friction, and it works almost, but not quite, as well as a piston ring. Don't worry, some leakage of steam is okay, and your engine will still work, just not as efficiently. When you take steam from your boiler and vent it into a piston, the steam expands, pushing the piston up. As the steam cools, it condenses, which causes pressure in the piston to drop, and the outside air pressure to push that piston back down again. Since you generally want this steam to cool quickly, squirt cold water into the piston to speed up cooling. There's your engine. The up-down motion of the piston can drive a saw, power a pump, or be converted into circular motion via a crank. See Appendix H. And here we have Figure 22, a machine that will power your civilization, the steam engine. At the bottom, we have boiling water heated by a fire. The steam from this boiling water goes up through a pipe via a valve opened by the motion of a lever above that pushes steam into the piston. The piston is attached to a lever that pivots up and down, which is attached to a pump or any other load. Beside the piston, there's a vat of cold water that's pushed into the piston when the valve is opened by the motion of the lever. This is your steam engine. So this brings your steam engine to the state of the art in 1698 CE. But if you're suspecting that heating and then cooling that same piston over and over wastes a whole bunch of energy, then put on a deerstalker and call yourself Sherlock Holmes because your suspicions are correct. Footnote. Deerstalkers are a hat that hunters used to wear when hunting deer, hence the name. These days, they're better known as Sherlock Holmes hats. See the next footnote. Footnote 2. Sherlock Holmes is a fake detective who never existed, but who everyone agrees to imagine is the best at solving crimes. If you want to reintroduce this character to your civilization, feel free. You can even enhance him from the version you remember by dressing him up like a bat, giving him a giant bat's cave to use as his lair, similar bat-themed cars, planes, and orangs, and having the police project his symbol into the sky whenever there's a crime nearby that needs solving. This version of Sherlock Holmes has historically been much more successful with the general public, especially when he's supplied with a murder clown to be his arch-nemesis. You may also want to reinvent comics. End of footnote. You can advance your engine almost 80 years by changing its design so that the hot parts stay hot and the cool parts stay cool. Do this by introducing a connection from your piston to a separate condensation chamber, which gets opened by the piston rising. The high pressure of the piston environment pushes the steam into the condensation chamber, which you can quickly cool with a spray of cold water. If you don't want to build a piston, there's another way to generate power with steam, and it's actually the first ones humans discovered way back around 100 CE. It's called a eolipile, and you make one by boiling water and directing the steam into a rotating sphere with exit nozzles positioned like this. And here we have the machine, which is a heated container of water that collects the steam into a rotating sphere with exit nozzles positioned such that they both push the sphere to rotate in the same direction. It's labeled Figure 23, a machine that could have powered the ancient Greek civilization, the eolipile. The steam coming out of the nozzles acts as jets, spinning the sphere. This is a steam-powered rocket engine, but the Greeks who invented it never considered it to be anything more than a toy. You're about to show them up, because you're about to turn your eolipile into a gosh darn dynamo. As you'll see in section 10.6.2, dynamos transform mechanical rotation into direct current, electricity, by exploiting the fact that wires moving through a magnetic field get a current induced in them. By putting a motionless magnet inside the sphere and wrapping wires around the outside of your rotating sphere, you'll generate power. And if you don't want to build eolipiles, you can always direct your jets of steam to fan blades on a turbine, similar to how you powered your Pelton turbine with water, and you'll generate rotational motion and electricity if you want that way instead. Footnote. As we saw, eolipiles were invented around 100 CE, but it wasn't until 1831 CE that the principle behind dynamos was discovered, and these steam engines were finally put to productive use. There is one exception. They were used in the Ottoman Empire in 1551 CE to rotate meat on a spit. End footnote. Here's the bad news. All steam engines, whether piston-based, rocket-based, or otherwise, are fundamentally inefficient. No matter what you do, lots and lots of energy gets wasted as heat. Even with higher pressure steam, condensers, and multiple expansion steam engines, which are engines that use steam to move a piston more than once, your engines probably won't get much better than 20% efficiency. But even the most advanced steam engines in the modern era range from just 40 to 50% efficiency, so don't feel too bad. They still power our world, and they'll power yours just fine too. The other major weakness of steam engines is their power-to-weight ratio. All that metal and water in a steam engine is heavy, and while they work great in buildings or in giant vehicles where their added weight isn't a huge factor, think trains and giant boats, they're less useful in smaller vehicles like planes and cars. For those scenarios, you'll want to invent the lighter internal combustion engine. Steam engines are external combustion. You burn something outside the engine to produce steam, and then pipe that steam into your engine. Internal combustion cuts out the middleman entirely and instead has you blowing something up inside the piston itself to move it. A volatile fuel gets mixed with air, so it'll burn easily, which is pushed into a piston cylinder and compressed. An electrical spark causes ignition, pushing the piston out, and as it resets, exhaust gases are expelled. Footnote. This is how gasoline-powered engines work, at least. A diesel engine works in the opposite way. Diesel is introduced as the piston is compressing, and the sudden increase in pressure and heat causes the fuel to ignite. Either way, it'll probably be some time before you're dealing with gasoline or diesel as fuel, especially if you haven't brought with you your copy of How to Distill Crude Oil, also known as petroleum, into kerosene, gasoline, diesel, and other fuels, chemicals that can be catastrophic for the environment, but will let you have some pretty cool race cars, so wow, hopefully they're worth it. But you can always brew less powerful ethanol to use as fuel in a pinch. Each piston travels through this cycle of intake, compression, combustion, and exhaust, so that one piston is firing as the others are resetting. These engines are obviously a bit more complicated than steam engines. You're relying on a controlled series of explosions to drive your engine instead of good old water, but the problems involved aren't insurmountable. Four pistons in series can be arranged so that one is exploding as another is refueling. This gives you a more constant thrust, and cams on a rod can be used to coordinate intake and outtake valves so that the pistons work properly in series. Another rod can be bent and attached to each piston to coordinate the thrust, which itself is connected to a flywheel to smooth out its motion. See section 10.5.3. So here we have figure 24, an internal combustion engine. Piston 1 is combusting fuel, piston 2 is venting exhaust, piston 3 is intaking fuel, and piston 4 is compressing the fuel in preparation to burn it. You'll get there. At the top we have a camshaft with 8 cams on it. Each of these controls an intake valve and an outtake valve on the four pistons. At the bottom, a crankshaft coordinates the movement of these valves so that they're moving in series, combusting, then venting, then intaking, then compressing. At the end of the crankshaft is a flywheel, which smooths out the thrust of this engine. But before you rush towards inventing an internal combustion engine, keep in mind, they're more complicated to build, more expensive to run, and require higher grade fuel. In an era when you have to invent everything from scratch, something like your steam engine, a machine that runs on water and is powered by literally anything that burns, is invaluable. 10.6. No, I mean, I'm so lazy, I just want to flip a switch and have machines work as if by magic. For machines that run at the flip of a switch, you want a source of power that's instantly ready, silent, and invisible. You want electricity. Electricity travels well, stores easily, and powers much of our modern world, including everything from aircraft to automobiles. It can power your world, too. Batteries use chemical reactions to generate power on demand, and some can even be recharged by reversing the reaction. Generators rely on a simple law of physics to turn physical motion into electrical power, and transformers change electrical charges into more useful forms, all without a single moving part. The generation, storage, and transformation of electricity is the technology that allows your civilization, for the first time, to expand away from its sources of power and settle almost anywhere on the planet. Electricity allows you to conquer the world, and you're only one page away from discovering it. 10.6.1. Batteries. Magnetism, as you will recall from physics class, is a powerful force that causes certain items to be attracted to refrigerators. You. Also, Dave Barry. What they are. A way to generate and store electrical current. Before they were invented, if you wanted portable electric power, you needed to carry around electric eels, and they're not exactly practical and predictable energy sources. Footnote. And yes, the electric eel is actually a fish. People who know that electric eels are actually fish tend to be really touchy about this, almost as much as those who know peanuts are actually legumes, koala bears are actually marsupials, or guinea pigs are actually rodents. Instead of getting mad at us, just go ahead and name things better than we ever did, okay? End footnote. Originally invented, 1745 CE for the first batteries that stored static electricity, and 1800 CE for the first chemical batteries that produce current. Prerequisites. Metal, for wires. Copper is very pliable and can be stretched out into wire shapes pretty easily. Metal for batteries, copper or silver for one end, and iron or zinc at the other work great. How to invent. To understand your battery, you'll need to understand electricity. And to understand electricity, you'll need to know about magnetism too. Humans used to think that electricity and magnetism were two different things. But then we found out they were so connected that you can't get one without the other, so we joined them together in our heads and called that new force electromagnetism. The discovery and use of electromagnetism drove the second industrial revolution, which, for the second time, as you may have guessed, reinvented the way humans lived. Before electromagnetic technology, everyone had to live either right beside a source of fuel, forests for wood, mines for coal, rivers for water wheels, etc., or else pay to have those fuels delivered to them. Afterward, energy could be shipped across the country at anywhere from 50 to 99% the speed of light, and people could now live comfortably anywhere we could run a wire to. Footnote: electrical energy always travels at the speed of light in a vacuum, but outside of one, its speed is affected by whatever it's traveling through. Don't worry, though. 50% of the speed of light is still insanely fast. It's 50% of the ultimate speed limit of the universe, see Appendix F, and with the naked eye, you won't be able to notice a difference anyway. End footnote. In short, mastery of electromagnetism will allow your civilization to expand beyond the riversides and mines to conquer the continent, the planet, and eventually, time itself. Footnote: the FC-3000 time machine is an electric, internal combustion, and cold fusion hybrid. End footnote. So here's how you do that. Electricity is the movement of charged particles, usually electrons, and you can see what are things made of in Section 11, Chemistry, for more information on those bad boys. Electrons have a negative charge, so something with a lot of electrons will itself be negatively charged, and whatever material is losing those electrons will gain a positive charge. Remember, similarly charged particles will push each other apart, while opposite charged particles will draw each other together. Some materials let electrons move through themselves easily. These are called conductors, and metals like copper, iron, silver, or zinc are great ones, and some keep them tightly in place and resist carrying a current. These are called insulators, and glass, rubber, and wood are all decent examples of those. But under normal conditions, the movement of electrons in a conductor is completely random. To generate electricity, you need to somehow get those electrons all moving the same way. We call this an electric circuit, because the electrons move in a loop, and you're so great that you're going to invent the first electric circuit and the first battery at the same time. Batteries are really easy to come up with once you've got metal, so again, it's pretty embarrassing it took us until 1800 CE to figure them out. They convert chemical reactions into electrical energy, and work by managing how two metals react with each other. Any two different metals have different affinities for electrons, so if you put them in a conducting solution, a chemical reaction will take place in which those electrons are exchanged. This conducting material is called an electrolyte, and it can be many things: acid, salt water, or even a delicious potato. Most salts, bases, and acids will do the job, and you can make sulfuric acid, a particularly good electrolyte, in Appendix C.12. The metal that wants more electrons will draw them from the other, causing that metal, called the terminal, to gain a negative charge, while the other becomes positively charged. These negatively charged electrons gathering in that electron-hungry terminal repel each other, so if you connect a wire between that terminal and the positively charged one, the electrons will escape the crowds by running along that wire toward the positive end. Hey, you just induced electrons to move in the same direction along your conducting wire. My friend, you've just made electricity. Footnote: the first battery was made by putting silver and zinc in a stack, separated by brine-soaked cardboard. This worked, but the electrolyte is also involved in the reaction, and over time, it becomes less conductive. It was improved 36 years later by giving each piece of metal its own different electrolyte and joining the two cells by a bridge, known as a salt bridge, since it can be as simple as a saltwater-soaked piece of paper, to allow the two electrolytes to exchange ions, keeping them electrically neutral. This battery used copper dunked in a copper sulfate electrolyte, and you can make that by adding copper to concentrated sulfuric acid, and zinc in a sulfuric acid electrolyte. This Daniell battery, named of course by the Mr. John Frederick Daniell who invented it, your name is probably way better, produced more reliable power, so feel free to steal the idea. End footnote. You'll use electricity to invent electric lighting, electric heating, electric cooking, electric engines, and more, and in just a few paragraphs too, but for now sit tight because we're not quite done with your new battery yet. It uses a chemical reaction to generate power, but eventually those metals will react all they can and your battery will die. Hey, you want to keep going and invent rechargeable batteries in the same day? Why not, right? Lead acid batteries, first invented in 1859 CE, are like the two-terminal battery you just invented, but use lead-based terminals instead, which sit in an electrolyte that's a 3-to-1 mixture of salt and sulfuric acid. One terminal is pure lead, and the other is lead dioxide. These metals react with sulfuric acid to produce lead sulfate at both terminals, but this reaction requires that the two terminals exchange electrons. So when you connect these two terminals with a wire, you'll generate electricity along that wire for as long as that reaction takes place. And critically, when you reverse the process and run electricity into the battery, the reaction runs in reverse. Lead sulfates dissolve back into the electrolyte, and you reproduce your two terminals, pure lead at one end and lead dioxide at the other. This reversible reaction means you've effectively stored power in this battery for future use. Footnote. It also means you can generate the lead dioxide you need for your battery. Just put pure lead in sulfuric acid and run electricity through it, and lead dioxide will form on the surface of your lead. End footnote. So now you've got batteries that generate new power, and another kind that store existing power. And while batteries are great to experiment with, build upon, and eventually power the latest mass-market portable music players, the fact is, you don't build a civilization on batteries. What you build a civilization on is a way to generate power that doesn't require someone to mine certain metals or synthesize different acids just to turn on the lights. In other words, you build them on electrical generators, otherwise known as power plants. And the best part is, if you've already read up on water wheels, windmills, or turbines, you've basically already invented them. 10.6.2. Generators. We will make electricity so cheap that only the rich will burn candles. You. Also, Thomas Edison. What they are. A way to produce energy up to and beyond 1.21 gigawatts. Before they were invented, the only way to get 1.21 gigawatts of electricity was to wait for a bolt of lightning, and unfortunately, you never know when or where one's ever going to strike. Originally invented, 1819 CE, this is when electricity and magnetism were recognized as united phenomena called electromagnetism, 1821 CE for the first electric motor, and 1832 CE for the first dynamo to generate electrical power from motion. Prerequisites, metal. You'll also need water wheels, turbines, or other ways to generate rotational motion. How to invent? We've been focused on the electricity part of electromagnetism, but here we'll take advantage of the fact that every electrical current also generates a magnetic field. You can prove it by placing a compass, section 10.12.2, next to a wire. The instant that wire starts carrying current, the compass will move. Incidentally, by doing this, you just use magnetism to turn electrical power into physical movement, which unlocks all sorts of inventions. Trivially, you can use it to make the world's first tools to measure and quantify electrical power. Getting a bit more complex, if you wrap your electrical wire around an iron core, you'll enhance that wire's magnetic field, thereby producing the world's first electromagnet, a powered magnet that you can turn on and off. Mount a magnet so it can rotate freely, put it between electromagnets on the opposite sides, and turn them on and off in sequence, and your magnet will spin for as long as you run power. This is the foundation of the electric motor. These inventions work by using electricity to produce movement in a magnetic field, but the opposite is also true. You can use movement in a magnetic field to induce an electrical current. That's the foundation for generators, which you technically already invented in section 10.5.4 steam engines when you turned the yellow pile into a dynamo, and it's still the basis of power production today. The core mechanic is incredibly simple. Get something to rotate, wrap that rotating thing in coils of wire, and put a magnet in the middle, and you'll generate electricity. The electricity generated this way is called alternating current, or AC, because the electrons move back and forth along the wire with each rotation. This contrasts with the direct current, or DC, you are making with your batteries. That's all it takes to invent a generator. Conveniently, AC works better than DC for long-distance transmission, but that didn't stop a war of the currents in our history when different American corporations, backing competing AC and DC power systems, tried to convince the public that it was the other electrical standard that was dangerously deadly. Footnote. This fight included public battles over whose power would run through the first electric chair, each wanted the other to be responsible for the death, for PR reasons, public demonstrations of animals being electrocuted by the competition's electricity, and even the proposal of an electric duel, in which representatives from each company would be shocked by equal but increasing amounts of electrical power from their own systems, with the first to quit being the loser. This duel never happened in our timeline, but other time travelers have proven that in this period of high tension, it takes only a well-timed shout of, "Hey, that guy said the other guy was too much of a wimp to get electrocuted for business reasons," to set this particular event into motion. End footnote. You can transmit your power from your generation stations along wires, but you'll hit a limitation. Any conductor has some resistance, which is the loss of electrical power to heat. This means that any wires can only carry so much power before they start heating up and, if it goes too far, melting. You can productively use this resistance to invent the toaster, stoves, ovens, electric heaters, hair dryers, and light bulbs we teased earlier, but to send power long distances, you'll need to adjust the nature of that power. That's where transformers come in. You should definitely invent those next. Footnote: incandescent light bulbs are, at their core, just a wire overloaded to the point where it glows but doesn't quite melt. This took a lot of experiments to find a metal that worked best for this. The eventual solution, tungsten, will work for you too, but it can be a tricky metal to find and extract. Instead, do what early inventors of light bulbs did and use a carbon filament, which you can produce by heating bamboo or paper without burning them, using the same techniques you use to turn wood into charcoal in section 10.1.1. These filaments won't last as long, but when you run electricity through them in a vacuum, they'll glow instead of burning. And if you're saying, "I can't produce a vacuum so easily, why would you assume that I can whip up a vacuum whenever I want? That's almost as crazy as the very nature of my present circumstances," just use arc lamps instead. These are two conductors with some space between them, so the electricity jumps across and generates light. End footnote. 10.6.3. Transformers. Let the future tell the truth, and evaluate each one according to its work and accomplishments. The present is theirs. The future, for which I really worked, is mine. You. Also, Nikola Tesla. What they are: a way to safely manipulate electricity to make it safe for transport. Before they were invented, moving electricity long distances was wasteful and dangerous, but to be honest, most civilizations invent transformers pretty quickly after figuring out electricity, so you probably should too. Originally invented, 1831 CE, for the principles of magnetic induction being discovered, and 1836 CE, for the first transformer. Prerequisites: electricity and metal. How to invent. We've been discussing electricity without using a lot of units, mostly because they're named after people who, from your perspective, likely haven't even been born yet, and who wants to give them all the credit. But we'll introduce one here: the volt. The volt measures a difference in electrical potential energy between two points in a circuit. If you think of electricity like water, then your wires are pipes, current is the amount of water moving through those pipes, and voltage is the pressure driving the water along. If you want more water from a pipe, you can either increase its size, increase its pressure, or both. Footnote: we haven't given you the precise definition for a volt here, because in the modern era, it's more than a bit messy. It's based on the ampere, which is defined either as approximately equivalent to 6.2415093 × 10⁻¹⁸ elementary charges moving past a boundary in 1 second, or the constant current which, if maintained in two straight parallel conductors of infinite length, of negligible circular cross-section, and placed 1 meter apart in a vacuum, would produce between those conductors a force equal to 2 × 10⁻¹⁷ newtons per meter of length. These definitions? Completely useless. Feel free to come up with your own measurements of volts, i.e. pressure, and amps, i.e. current, whatever way you want. End footnote. The same holds true for electricity. The power you get is a factor of current times voltage. The catch is, the more current you have, the more heat a wire is going to generate and the closer you are to it melting. This leaves you, like in water pipes, with two options. You can either make your pipes bigger, thickening your wires to increase the amount of current they can carry before melting, or increase their pressure, i.e., increasing your voltage. High voltage wires are more dangerous to be around, but if you could transform your electricity up to high voltage for cross-country transportation, away from people and their curious, grabby, wire-touching hands, and then transform it down to safer, lower voltages for use, you'd be set. Footnote: well, technically, high voltage combined with sustained current is what's so dangerous. A sustained charge of 50 volts is enough to conduct through your skin, interrupt your heartbeat, and start cooking your organs. And yet a simple static electricity charge carries up to 20,000 volts. So what gives? The answer is that, yes, while touching a doorknob after rubbing your feet on the carpet does produce a high voltage shock, it's one with very little current and discharges within a nanosecond. A nanosecond of high voltage is fine. It's the fact that high voltage wires carry sustained current that makes them so deadly. End footnote. Transformers are simple since they have no moving parts, except, of course, the electrons moving through their wires. Make a large, square ring of iron. Coil an insulated wire connected to your incoming alternating current around one side. On the opposite side, make another coil to transmit your outgoing current. The two coils of wire aren't connected electrically, but when current runs through your incoming coil, it'll create an electromagnetic field, just like we saw before, that will induce the electrons in your outgoing coil to move too. At this point, your latest invention doesn't transform electricity, yet, but it does use a magnetic field to wirelessly transmit electricity over a short distance. The real magic comes when you change the number of coils in your outgoing circuit. If two circuits have the same number of coils, currents and voltages in both wires will be identical. But if there are more coils in your outgoing wire, then the charge induced there will have decreased current and increased voltage, making it ideal for long-distance transmission. If there are fewer coils, you'll decrease your voltage and increase your current, making your electricity ready for local use. Voltage is directly proportional to the number of coils, so a 3-to-1 ratio of coils in and out will produce an outgoing current at 1/3 the voltage as incoming. Turns out, iron and some coiled-up wire is all it takes to transform electricity, and it's all possible because electricity and magnetism are two sides of the same coin. Thanks, electromagnetism. So with the other inventions in this section, you can now produce, transmit, store, and transform electricity. It's worth noting that, just as batteries could have been invented at any point in history once basic metals were discovered, so too could have power plants and transformers. Even when humans had invented water wheels and windmills, they still used them to generate direct force, turning wheels, moving cranks, for more than 2,000 years before anyone thought of inventing the dynamo and producing a much more versatile and transmittable electric current. With your knowledge of the steam engine and the dynamo, you now have the ability to produce two distinct industrial revolutions in your society at any point in history you choose. 10.7. It's late, and I'm cold, and I'd like to know how late and how cold it is. Clocks are the first inventions that allow you to precisely quantify time. This, it turns out, is a surprisingly deep subject, even in a world that predates the invention of rental market time machines. And once you have glass, you just need a little cleverness and a little water to invent thermometers and barometers, which let you quantify heat and pressure for the first time too. Wanting machines to tell you the temperature and time may, given your current circumstances, seem like superficial and even useless desires, but they aren't. The technologies in this section unlock leaps forward in fields as disparate as manufacturing, chemistry, medicine, and even weather prediction, which you will definitely want to have sooner rather than later. And while the digital clocks you remember from the world you left behind might seem more advanced than the ones you're about to invent, don't worry. You'll soon make up for lost time. 10.7.1. Clocks. Being with you and not being with you is the only way I have to measure time. You. Also, Jorge Luis Borges. What they are. An actual time machine, though only in the what time is it sense, not in the sense of finally, at long last, instructions for a device that will return me to my native time. Sorry. Before they were invented, the passage of time was not quantified, which meant it was measured in more qualitative ways, like from sunrise to sundown. On the plus side, if someone asked you what time it was and you lied to them, they could never prove you wrong. Originally invented, 1600 BCE for water clocks, 1500 BCE for sundials, 350 CE for the hourglass in ancient Greece, 700 CE for the hourglass being rediscovered in Europe, 1300 CE for hourglasses to become common in Europe, 1656 CE for pendulum clocks, and 1927 CE for quartz clocks. Prerequisites: pottery for water clocks, glass for hourglasses, latitude and compasses for sundials. How to invent. Modern wristwatches use tiny pieces of quartz to keep time. It's the second most abundant mineral on Earth, and it has a useful property called piezoelectricity. When you squeeze a quartz crystal, a small amount of electricity is generated, and when you do the reverse and run a small amount of electricity through quartz, the crystal vibrates at a predictable rate. This allows the construction of cheap electronic clocks, and in the modern era, tiny pieces of rock vibrating 32,768 times per second are the world's most widely used timekeeping technology. But since you don't have modern electronics or quartz crystals, you'll be relying on simpler inventions to duplicate modern clocks. A clock actually has two functions. A properly set clock can tell you what time it is, but even a watch set to the wrong time can measure how much time has passed since a given moment. If you're just interested in tracking the passage of time, then a much simpler invention, like water clocks, can solve your problem. Water clocks were the first clocks invented, and the simplest versions are dead easy. Just poke a tiny hole in a container of water. You're done. Water will drip out at a reasonably constant rate, and so by marking the fill line and then measuring how much water drains out from your bucket over different units of time, you can measure minutes, hours, and with a gigantic enough bucket, even days. Until the invention of pendulum clocks in the 1600 CE, water clocks were the most accurate and commonly used devices to measure time, so you're doing great. Hourglasses work on the same principle as water clocks, but use sand instead of water and recycle the sand every time you turn them over. A few handfuls of sand, with a hole small enough to limit sand consumption but large enough to avoid jamming, will track, you guessed it, about an hour, and you can add or remove sand to get the exact unit of time you're interested in. If you have an hourglass, you can technically measure as many hours as you want, just flip it over when the sand runs out and mark down how many times you've flipped it, but this requires constant vigilance, and errors are going to creep in. To avoid having to flip over hourglasses or refill water clocks, you'll want to invent the sundial, which, during sunny days at least, indicates the time of day. Sundials are easy to build. Just shove a stick in some flat ground and mark its shadow over a day and you've built one. But they're a bit complicated to get right, especially if you want to know precisely what hour it is, which we imagine you do, because otherwise you could just glance up at the sun and say, looks about quitting time, and leave it at that. First, rather than shoving your sundial stick straight into the ground, you'll stick it in at an angle equal to your latitude, which you can determine in section 10.12.3, latitude and longitude, and positioned so that it's pointing towards true north, which you won't know, but magnetic north is a good approximation in most time periods, see section 10.12.2. If you've done this accurately, then the stick's shadow at noon will always be directly underneath it, and 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. will always be at 90 degree angles to it on either side. To get the angles for the remaining hours, use the following formula, where L is your latitude and H is your hour. Angle is equal to the inverse tangent of the sine of L times the tangent of H. Didn't memorize your trig tables before you went back in time? No worries, it's crazy to do that, and full trig tables are included in Appendix E to make this calculation easy. There is a catch. Even after all this measurement and math, your sundial still isn't going to be accurate. If you have a watch to compare it to, and hopefully you do because staring at your watch in horror is de rigueur in the time travel aesthetic, you'd see your sundial varies in inaccuracy throughout the year, becoming up to around 15 minutes fast or slow. The good news is, for once, this isn't your fault, and these errors aren't happening because you made your sundial poorly. They're happening because the sun is lying to you. Or, more precisely, the Earth is causing the sun to lie to you. The planet's conspiring to mess up your sundial in two different ways. The first happens because Earth's yearly orbit around the sun isn't a perfect circle the way we like to imagine it. It's actually very slightly oval, with the sun a little off to one side. This ovalness is called eccentricity. Here we have an image, figure 25. It shows a circular orbit and an eccentric orbit. A circular orbit is a perfect circle with the sun at the middle, and an eccentric orbit is a flattened oval with the sun at one side and the Earth at the other, spinning around that oval. Figure 25 is labeled circular and eccentric orbits. These images should not be taken literally, as they are exaggerated for illustrative purposes. Earth's eccentric orbit is not nearly so extreme, for example, and usually the Earth itself is larger than a few millimeters tall. In eccentric orbits, planets don't always orbit at the same speed. Rather, they speed up as they orbit close to the Sun, and slow down as they orbit farther away. Footnote: this eccentricity itself varies slightly over time, forming a rough 100,000-year cycle. These changes in Earth's orbital speed lengthen summers or winters, depending on which hemisphere you're in. End footnote. Earth's eccentric orbit causes the Sun to appear at the same spot in the sky up to 8 minutes earlier or later than it would with a perfectly circular orbit, which means your sundial is going to be up to 8 minutes off true time at different points in the year. The other factor is Earth's angled rotation. Rather than rotating straight up, like a top, it actually rotates on an angle, about 23.5 degrees off vertical. This is called axial tilt, and it causes the Sun to appear higher and lower in the sky at the same time of day, adding up to 10 minutes of error to your sundial. Footnote: and just to make it more complicated, this axial tilt changes over time too, varying from 22.1 to 24.5 degrees on a rough 41,000-year cycle. When axial tilt is higher, the differences between seasons become more pronounced, with colder winters and warmer summers. To measure the current axial tilt of Earth in your time, wait until the June solstice, when the Earth's rotational axis is most inclined towards the Sun, see section 10.12.3, and put a stick in the ground. Make sure it's vertical, then measure the length of its shadow when the Sun is at the highest point in the sky. Take the inverse tangent of the length of that shadow, with those trig tables in Appendix E, divide that by the length of the stick, and you'll get an angle. You're almost done. Now you just need to measure your latitude. Again, refer to section 10.12.3. If you're north of the northern tropic, which is the northernmost point where the Sun reaches a point directly overhead at least once a year, its latitude is identical to the Earth's axial tilt and will be anywhere from 22.1 to 24.5 degrees. Subtract your measurement from your latitude. If you live south of the equator, subtract your latitude from your measurement. And if you're between the equator and the northern tropic, add your latitude and measurement together instead. The result, at last, is Earth's current axial tilt. End footnote. Eccentricity alters the apparent time of the Sun on a one-year cycle, while axial tilt does it on a half-year cycle, like so. Here we have figure 26, the separate effects of orbital eccentricity and axial tilt. Both are on graphs with the difference in minutes on the x-axis and the number of days in the year on the y-axis. Orbital eccentricity starts at 0 at the beginning of the year, moves down to almost negative 8, crosses up to positive 8 midway through the year, and goes back down to 0 near the end of the year, in a gentle curve. The effect of axial tilt is very similar to orbital eccentricity, but faster. Here we go almost negative 10, curving back up to almost positive 10, down again, back up, and down again throughout the year, with two full cycles. So at one point in the year, the eccentric orbit might be subtracting a certain number of minutes, while axial tilt might be adding some. By combining these two charts together, we can see their cumulative effect, showing what adjustments you need to make to the apparent time on your sundial to actually get accurate time. Here we have figure 27, the combined effects of orbital eccentricity and axial tilt. So this chart has the same difference in minutes on the y-axis and the number of days in the year on the x-axis. At 50 days in, it drops down to around negative 15. By 140 days in the year, we're up to around positive 4. By 200 days in the year, we're down to around negative 3. And by 300 days in the year, we're up to around 15 minutes, which then drops down to around negative 3 by the end of the year. Footnote: this chart is historically known by the very impressive name of the Equation of Time, with the word equation there being used in its medieval sense of reconciling a difference. The Equation of Time is, sadly, unrelated to the actual temporal equations that brought you here and will therefore be of no use to returning you back home again, so you should give up on that fantasy already. Believe us, we would not have gotten this far into writing this book if there were any easier option. End footnote. There is, of course, one more catch. Both orbital eccentricity and axial tilt slowly change over time, and the Earth itself is precessing too, which means it's very slowly wobbling like a top, See section 10.12.3 for more. If you apply this chart without adjusting for your current time period, you'll introduce a few seconds of error for every century you are away from the present, which quickly adds up. You can attempt to alter this chart, built for Earth's current eccentricity, axial tilt, and precession, by factoring in the following measurements of how they've changed over the past 10 million years. Here we have figure 28, which is a million years of data to measure Earth's movement, here reduced to a few squiggly lines on a chart. The first chart is Earth's eccentricity back to 1 million BCE. It goes up and down, ranging from about 0 to about 0.05, with local maximums around 950,000 BCE, 600,000 BCE, and 200,000 BCE. The next chart is Earth's axial tilt back to 1 million BCE, which goes up and down ranging from 22 degrees to 24.5 degrees across the same time range. Finally, we see Earth's precession back to 1 million BCE, which rotates from 0 to 360 degrees every 100,000 years or so, with a jog around 900,000 BCE, where Earth was probably hit by something big. Endnote. Without time machines, nobody can make these measurements precisely, but the data here matches up with the estimates made in the paper I found, titled Obliquity and Precession for the Last 5 Million Years by A.L. Berger. And endnote. But, at this point, it's probably worthwhile to tell you that you don't actually need to know exactly what time it really is anyway, and that the 15 minutes of error we're going to such lengths to correct honestly don't matter. It's only in the last few centuries that accurate time measurement became at all important, and then initially only to calculate longitude at sea, a requirement you'll be sidestepping entirely, see section 10.12.3, latitude and longitude. Even today, the vast majority of humans live out their lives not according to what time the sun actually says it is, but rather to a mere approximation of that time. That's what time zones are. Groups of people agreeing to pretend it's a single time across large areas of the planet, thereby doing away with the confusion that comes from each town keeping its own slightly different times by the sun. Time zones were first used within nations in 1847 CE, and worldwide time zones were proposed a few decades later. Invent time zones now, and not only will the approximate time that your unadjusted sundial produces do just fine, but you'll also save yourself a bunch of math homework. 10.7.2, thermometers and barometers. You will hear thunder and remember me and think, she wanted storms. You. Also, Anna Akhmatova. What they are. A way to measure heat with thermometers and pressure with barometers. Before they were invented, people just kind of guessed at how hot things were, what temperatures they were cooking at, and what the weather was going to be like. Footnote. Before thermometers, various methods were used for measuring temperature in kitchens. The crudest way was simply to stick your hand inside your oven, fireplace, or hearth, and see how much it hurt, but this has, hopefully obvious, downsides. In France, in the 1800s CE, pieces of white paper were used to measure temperature, with the color they turned in an oven after a set period of time, assuming they didn't instantly combust, giving a measure of how hot things were. Dark brown heat was good for glazing pastries. Slightly cooler, light brown heat was good for pie crusts. Dark yellow heat was best for larger pastries, and the coolest, light yellow heat for meringues. End footnote. Originally invented, 1593 CE for the water thermoscope, 1643 CE for the barometer, 1654 CE for the alcohol thermoscope, 1701 CE for the idea of a temperature scale, and 1714 CE for the mercury thermometer. Prerequisites. You need glass, and you need a liquid. Water, alcohol, wine, oil, mercury, urine, all of these and more have been used. How to invent. Both thermometers and barometers measure things that would otherwise be invisible, and you can invent both of them with just water and glass. For thermometers, the property we'll be exploiting is the fact that most liquids and gases expand when they're heated and contract when they freeze. Measure this expansion and contraction, and you can measure temperature. The first thermometers weren't that far from what you'd recognize today. Long glass tubes with a ball at one end, with the open end of the tube placed in a bucket or lake when the ball was hot. The air in the ball would contract when cooled, pulling water up the tube, and expand when it was warm, pushing water down. The problem was, there was no scale. All this device could tell you was whether things were getting warmer or colder. These were thermoscopes, a way to see temperature, rather than thermometers, a way to measure it. Knowing humanity's track record, as you now do, you will not be surprised that it took more than 100 years after thermoscopes were invented for anyone to think of applying a fixed scale to them. Two men, Isaac Newton and Ole Rømer, finally came up with this idea independently in 1701 CE, but Rømer's scale was better. Newton used a lot of subjective temperature references. The heat at midday about the month of July is one. What the heck, Newton? Well, Rømer at least used constants like the freezing and boiling points of water as a basis for his temperature scale. Footnote, you can build a temperature scale around anything, as some of Newton's whimsically useless temperature references illustrate, but physical constants are better. They'll make your measurements consistent and reproducible, even if, for some reason, you don't have access to Isaac Newton's backyard, in summer, on an Earth whose climate approximates what it was like in England in 1701 CE. See section 4 to reproduce the centigrade scale of measurement used in this book. End footnote. There's another problem. Since the water in a thermoscope is open to air, it's also susceptible to changes in pressure, which actually makes this invention a combination thermoscope and barometer, or thermobaroscope. Sealing the glass solves this problem by removing air pressure as a factor. With a sealed glass ball at the bottom, filled with liquid, and a glass ball at the top, filled with air, you can produce a thermoscope immune to changes in pressure. Put a scale on the outside, and you've made a thermometer. Ta-da! The problem is this. Water is weird, and doesn't expand or contract linearly. Like most things, it gets denser as it cools, but as you drop below 4 degrees centigrade, it actually expands, which is why ice floats on water instead of sinking. Ice is less dense than water. Footnote. It's also why you can use lakes to cool your buildings when your civilization gets to that point. When water reaches around 4 degrees centigrade, 3.98 degrees if we're being exact, it's at its maximum density. This means that all water in a lake that isn't at 4 degrees will float above the water that is, which makes the water at the bottom of a large enough lake all but guaranteed to be a constant 4 degrees. You can pump this water through your buildings in summer as a renewable and efficient way to invent air conditioning. Lakes that are 50 meters or more deep, and far enough away from the equator that they don't get fully heated above 4 degrees, work best. End footnote. This makes water suboptimal for thermometers. Measurements between 4 degrees and 0 degrees will be off, and you won't be able to measure anything below 0 degrees because your thermometer will be frozen. Modern thermometers use mercury, which expands dramatically with heat, boils at a distant 357 degrees, and doesn't freeze until 38 degrees below zero, but you probably won't have any of that for a while. Footnote. Mercury is the only metal that's liquid at room temperature. If you do want some, you can extract it from a bright red mineral named cinnabar, the veins of which are typically found near hot springs or sites of recent volcanic activity. It's toxic to humans, so be careful with it. To extract the mercury from cinnabar, crush the rock as small as possible and roast it. Use distillation, section 10.1.2, to collect and condense what evaporates off the rocks. Mercury's 357 degree boiling point is achievable even with just a campfire. And there's your mercury. Despite its toxicity, humans have been mining cinnabar since 8000 BCE, although back then it was used as a pigment. Crushed cinnabar produces a vibrant shade of red, now called vermilion. End footnote. Alcohol, section 10.2.5, expands more linearly and freezes all the way down at negative 173 degrees, but it boils at a mere 78 degrees, which is less convenient. You can always use more than one thermometer, alcohol thermometers for cold temperatures and water thermometers for warmer ones. Alternatively, wine, a delicious mixture of water and alcohol, has been used to mitigate the effects of alcohol's low boiling point and water's weirdness. So that's thermometers. Barometers are basically the same as you saw earlier when we invented a combination barometer-thermometer by accident. Take a hollow tube, fill it with liquid, seal one end, and put the open end in a body of the same liquid. That's a barometer. The weight of air pushes down on the liquid outside the tube, which prevents all the water inside the tube from draining out. Footnote, it wasn't until barometers were invented that humans realized air even had weight. Up to then, it was assumed to be weightless. After all, it floats, right? But all matter has mass, And air is just a layer of gas pressed to the Earth's surface by the same gravity that's holding you there, too. End footnote. Higher densities of outside air cause water to rise in the tube, which is how the barometer measures air pressure, and the vacuum at the top allows the water to expand into the tube easily.